So we have with us Mridula from Bolero, which is honestly the most on-point branding I've seen so far.
Thank you.
It brings back all those childhood gaming memories.
Yeah.
But I've seen the website as well. The copy, all of it is extremely on point.
Yeah, thank you.
Which is only fair because branding is your gig, right? Like from what I know, you guys have practically done the branding for half of Cyber Hub and Sector 29. You've got brands all the way from Dunkin' Botanist to Gulshan that are in your roster, right?
Yeah.
So what has that been like? Like when it comes to branding, is it something that you just jumped into it right from the start or did you build up to it? What was that journey like?
Okay, it's actually really weird because I did not graduate as a graphic designer. I never thought I'd be branding anything in my life. I graduated as an interior designer. Tried it out for a year, failed. Found Blue Vector somehow. And I was like, you guys, I love drawing. Can you just hire me? Force them to hire me. And the next thing you know, one of the first few brands we were working on was Dunkin'. And the logo was already sort of in place. And I had to pretty much work on the signage. But I think just even the fact that I generally didn't create the logo on my own, but just seeing it out in public and seeing it realized, yeah, it was really cool. Even stuff like Omo Cafe, seeing that huge logo out there, or even going in and seeing the placemat or like the coaster with the logo, it's quite a proud little moment.
Yeah.
It's funny.
What's that process like though? Because when it comes to the brand, most people are so attached to it. Everyone, I think, comes with their own vision around it, what they want it to do for them.
Right.
Which is, again, heavily influenced by the other things that they're seeing out there.
Right.
What does that process look like of carving out someone's brand for them, being like, here, this is the best thing that works for you?
Right. It's challenging for sure because I think anyone who approaches you already sort of has a preconceived notion about their brand in their mind. And I think for us, it's sort of like making them unlearn their brand or relearn their brand. And sometimes when you come in with an idea of your brand already, it could work, but it could also, you could just be going in the wrong direction. So I think it's for us to be like, you know, we get where you're coming from. Like, I think at the end of the day, you have to realize that branding isn't about you as a designer. It is about the brand, right? And you have to serve the brand well. You have to serve the people who own that brand well. You can't just give them something that you think works, but they know it doesn't work because they have industry experience, they have market experience, they know what works, they know what their clientele wants, right? So to negate that entirely is wrong, but also to sort of help them get out of their comfort zone and say, okay, try it a bit. We'll lay your foundation, we'll take what your learnings are as a foundation. But let's try to visually take your brand away from the rest of the world. Let's help it stand out, be a little experimental, take a risk. I think that's an exciting journey. And then it's always about compromise. Like we're shooting for here, they're shooting for here. And then you sort of meet them in midway where you're also satisfied with the outcome and you know it's going to serve the brand and the client well. And they know it's going to do justice to their brand. I think that's always finding that middle ground is always fun and tricky.
It's a complete spectrum. Like on one side, you have brands thinking about that, hey, this thing, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
This is what we want it to be like.
Yeah. And
on one side, you have, I mean, designers are creative individuals, right? They come with their own set of thoughts and they're like, hey, on this side of the spectrum, we have this and this is going to be fantastic. And the end goal is to sort of put those together and reach a place where the customer actually says,
exactly,
this is what we're looking for.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And what has that been, my question would be that, who has done that really well? Like when you see, and maybe you don't need to take names, but
right,
what are the brands that you see that, you know, either ones that work with you or otherwise, that you think take their brand and use it really well for their customer?
Right.
And second, others who are an absolute train wreck, like the equivalent of my shirt for a brand. What would that look like?
Okay. By the way, I really like your shirt, so I'm going to ignore all of
them. Of course.
But, okay, I think I will approach this from a slightly more personal level, which maybe I shouldn't, but say a brand that I have to use on a daily basis, a service, is like Slack, right? And I think for me, that's a brand that works. Slack and MailChimp are two things that I use almost on a daily basis. And for me, both those services work really well in, first of all, their interface, how a customer interacts with their service, and everything else they offer on top of that, right? Like, as a designer, being like, we're super visual as people, right? And if you were to give us an interface that's pretty basic and simple, like, it can be easy to interact with, but if it's too basic, we're just going to be like, okay, whatever, it is what it is. But see, something like Slack, just the fact that they have this cute little like emoji of their Slack bot,
yeah,
that's super cute. You go on their website, you buy a plan, and the first thing they say is, oh, you can now customize your own emojis. And that for you is super interesting, right? Because it keeps you engaged with their product. Like, it makes you feel like the product's made for you, like it's being customized for you. And that's something that's really interesting and fun that a brand can do. As opposed to, say, you go on the internet and you're looking, you come across a website that's super like overwhelming and overstimulating. So it can be like the biggest brand. Like, if, I mean, Alibaba and like IndiaMart are things I've heard about a lot. I hope no one sues me for this because I have no money. But you go on their website and it's really like jarring. You don't know where to begin because there's so much information that they put out there in your face. Like, I get it. People have been using it for years. They're great brands. And I'm sure once you start using it, it's easy to use and it's easy to, and it serves its purpose. But as a first-time user, if something super, if it's so overwhelming that you don't even want to start using it, that for me is like, yeah, bad design.
No, and I think these design sensibilities also really change with the audience or the geography that you're talking
about.
Yeah. Because one of the things I've seen is that when it comes to a lot of, I would say, like, for example, Japanese websites or South Korean ones,
right,
they are loud.
Yeah.
My God, there is so much going on at the same time. But that's what customers are used to.
That's
what folks... Minimalism, I'm not sure if that's something, yeah, that might work.
Yeah.
Right even over there.
I mean, minimalism, first of all, I hate minimalism. I'm not a minimalist.
Way out.
Yeah. I'm super maximalist, even with my designs, even with my illustrations, how I am as a person. But I'm not saying you need to be minimalistic, but, you know, there was this survey that said that if you ask people who use an app on a daily basis or a service on a daily basis, if they can point out what's wrong with the service, they won't be able to because they've gotten so used to using it that they don't see the flaws in it, right? But if you ask them how, like, to chart out their daily process with that service or that app or that business, that's when you realize the lack of that service, right? So, I mean, you can get used to something that's incorrect or, I mean, bad, but by using it a lot. I think there's something we do on almost on a daily basis with multiple things. But it's about wanting to improve, right? Like, it's about understanding that nothing's ever perfect. So you're constantly like improving to improve the experience a customer has with your product or service.
Yeah. It's easy to get boxed in when you haven't known any better.
Yeah.
But when you're really sort of throwing away all the, you know, notions that you have and just sit down to it and ask them that, how do you interact with this app?
Yeah.
Why do you do what you do?
Yeah.
And then getting to the foundational, the basics of it, that this is the problem you're looking to solve this.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, that works super well, right? Like,
yeah,
from the way that a brand like Notion does, like, they really took some of the most common tools that folks were using across the board when it, yeah, comes to a word processor or just page organization or,
yeah,
even something like a simpler version of a CRM and just bundled all of that, yeah, together in a maybe not the easiest to understand way, but it's really easy to get started.
Yeah.
So this is interesting because when I asked you about good brands, I didn't expect a segue to be this easy.
Okay.
But the two brands that you mentioned, Slack as well as MailChimp,
yeah,
they're both predominantly B2B apps.
Right.
They're both B2B products. And this is one of the challenges that we face a lot in the industry where when it comes to branding for B2B, the brief tends to be very different.
Yeah.
It is, a large chunk of it is internal, but it is one where most founders don't know that what is the value of a rebranding for me? What is the value of my, you know, of me setting up my brand in a way that both my team and my customers can understand?
Right.
Especially with the kind of convoluted offerings that B2B brands generally tend to reach for their either products or services. Right? So what's that been like when it comes to B2B products? Is there a marked difference? Isn't there? Is it just people trying to break something which are foundational design principles or foundation principles?
So the approach, I guess, is slightly different only in terms of, say if someone who's starting a restaurant comes to you, they will give you a profile of their customer, right? But someone, like if you are approached by a B2B brand, they will talk more about their service, right? They will say, this is what I provide. This is why my quality of services are good. These are my competitors. But it's less about the businesses they're providing to, right? And then you're sort of, it's almost more like a market research to say, like right now I have a brand who's, I have a client who's into ethanol manufacturing and he wants to brand his product. He essentially sells to OMCs, right? So when I share a branding questionnaire with him, it's more about, okay, this is what my manufacturing unit's like. These are the steps I take towards sustainability. And I feel like in that sense, they're sort of also limited by the market in a certain sense, right? Like business to business, that they are limited by the market in a certain way. But when it's like B2C, you're not as limited because you're sort of playing on the psyche of your customers and you're playing with their little emotions and you've seen their daily habits and you're sort of playing around with that. So I think you can be a lot more free when you're designing for B2C. With B2B, I do think, of course, you can be experimental and fun and free as well, but you do still have to be limited and restricted by some constraints. So like Slack, they went through a rebranding essentially. And the reason they went through a redesign is because they had a motive, which was a hashtag. And it had about 100 colors within that one motive, which when translated over your app, over your desktop, over their own marketing collaterals, was being repeated in different colors across every vertical, internally and externally. And that's where they saw the issue. Where they were like, there's no consistency in our brand, whether we're advertising it, whether it's our website, whether it's just the app in itself, which is when they went to Pentagram and they were like, sure, these are the 126 colors our logo currently has. This is the basis of what we want our logo to still be. And can you now design it for us? So something you keep in mind for B2B while designing anything is that it needs to be really clear and concise. It cannot be inconsistent across various platforms. So say if a brand is like, you know, I don't really see the value in branding as much, but I want to put all my money into marketing. So you see a really cool ad on TV, on your website, on Instagram, and you're like, hey, I kind of want to know what this brand's about. And you go on their website and it's not consistent with what their ad was about. First of all, I would be like, is this a fake website? Did someone create a fake website for them? And then I'd sort of also not trust them too much because I'm like, you're saying one thing here and you're saying another thing here. Who really are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that personality, that consistency, I think is one of the most important things when it comes to B2B. Because even when it comes to in being about emotions, right?
Yeah.
There's one of the things we've talked about internally earlier is that how B2B is becoming more and more emotion-driven, more and more personable. And how some of the largest B2B sales at this point are being driven through social.
Yeah.
But that's a very interesting sort of side of things that, you know, what's sort of happening there. But the one most, I would say, the highest impact that your brand can have as a B2B brand is exactly what you said. It is that consistency across platforms.
Yeah.
That people know that when they've seen you across a few channels, they remember you.
Yeah.
And your brand, not just the design, but the tone, the way that you talk, the things that you talk about, those stand out.
Exactly.
Because when you're dealing with ticket sizes that are anywhere from 10 to 10,000 times higher than, say, a B2C product might cost your time. So you're looking at things like enterprise sales. You're looking at things like where brands like Salesforce, HubSpot, they're selling like probably $100,000 retainers for a software over a year. Over there, making sure that a brand stays the same throughout, that it's just as memorable, it just becomes immensely important.
Yeah.
Something that you just can't do without.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel a lot of these brands lagging. Like, too many B2B brands at this point think that most of my sales are coming in through my personal connects.
Yeah.
Through a very active, which is another word for loud, outbound team that is reaching out everywhere and trying to find people who actually need these services, right? If that's where they're getting customers from, sometimes they fail to realize that, why do I need a very consistent and cohesive brand?
Yeah.
And yeah, those are the principles I think that we try to share with those teams as well.
Yeah.
But do you see this in B2C as well, where knowing the brand internally also becomes very important?
100%. I think with any brand, be it B2B, be it B2C, I think understanding the brand philosophy and sort of laying down the brand philosophy for yourself as a designer and for the owner of the brand is very important. I feel like a logo or a design can only do so much for your brand, right? The rest of it sort of relies on your brand philosophy and what you do with your brand. So say we had a client come up to us who wanted their logo to represent 20 different things. They wanted it to be warm, they wanted it to be holistic, they wanted it to be nature-driven, they wanted it to be farm-to-fork. And they wanted these 20 things to come across in their one logo unit. Which is when we were like, you know, your logo only speaks so much for you. The rest has to do with your services. The rest has to do with your brand philosophy. It has to do with, say, the customers who come to your restaurant. How are the servers greeting them? How are they being seated? What is the kind of experience they're going to have with your brand? Right? Like, it's so much more about the functioning of your brand. And I think when you lay down a philosophy, so you say that, okay, my brand stands for these five things, and you communicate it to everybody at every level of your company, no matter how big or small your company is. Your company could be 2 people, it could be 10,000 people. But I think if you tell those 10,000 people that these are the core values of my brand, it'll be easier for them to communicate it to their customers and their audiences, right? So your tone of voice for your brand in every vertical, in marketing, what your tone of voice should be, on a website, on an email, what your tone of voice should be. So I think just clarity in terms of your core values as a brand is very important in both B2B and B2C in design. Like, a logo does so much for you, like it puts you out there, it's visually there, but the rest is on you.
Mm.
Right, to communicate your brand's philosophy to the world. If I could ask you a question, how do you market a B2B brand differently than you would a B2C?
I think one of the things we've seen is that when it comes to B2B brands, there is a lot of overlap in terms of not just how the customer sees the brand, but how the team internally needs to see the brand. And in a lot of cases, that goes beyond just messaging and ethos.
Okay.
In a lot of cases, what we realize is that the product set needs to be restructured in a way that others can understand it.
Right.
Inside and outside. You have brands who have existed for anywhere from 10 to 100 years that have been in the space for a very long time. Let's look at some of the still younger ones, right? The 20 to 30 year old brands. And these are brands that started out with a product. They were very customer-oriented. They built on that product for what the customer wanted. They added new product segments. And by the end of it, what they have is a large model.
Okay.
And the senior leadership knows exactly what it's all about, but they have a horrible time trying to properly explain it.
Right.
The newer team that's come in is generally working in very specific silos, and they have little to no clue about how they can sort of connect the dots together. And when you have that kind of a model inside the organization, you can expect that a customer would understand it. Or to do something as simple as talking to them about their needs and cross-selling other services that these brands provide, it becomes an absolute mess in most cases, right? So, for example, one of the organizations we were working with, these guys started a very niche. They were a service provider for collection agencies, to begin with, right? So, collection agency fees are essentially, you know, when you don't pay your Ola and Uber fees, these guys buy out the debt, call you up. Which is a simpler use case. In most cases, they're working in much harsher conditions like healthcare and insurance and all that. But hopefully, we'll gloss over. So you have someone who started out as a service for that kind of an audience. For collection law firms, which are, like, they're probably like some 1,200, 1,500 law firms in the US. Number might have changed since we worked with them. And that's what they started out with. And then they realized that they could offer compliance software to these kind of audiences as well. That would, other than the manpower services, compliance would help. They realized that analytics would help or not. They realized that technology for their call centers would be another add-on feature. And by the end of it, what they have are a set of different softwares that mean different things to different folks in the collection lifecycle. Someone as an agency, a collection agency, a collection law firm, an actual bank or a debtor.
Yeah.
You're offering a variety of solutions to a variety of people without any one person knowing exactly what it's about.
Right.
And to sort of bring this together, to structure this in a way that, you know, we're like, okay, let's make this foundational. This is one platform. And this platform means different things for different audiences. But that's fine because it gives the right kind of clarity to the right kind of...
Yeah.
So when it comes to branding, what we realize is that it ties in so closely with the product or service that it needs us to be very closely involved at the highest level.
Right.
With that kind of branding.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm sure all kinds of B2B rebranding take that kind of approach because...
Yeah.
One of the brands that really stands out that I've seen do this so beautifully is Atlassian.
Okay.
They have complex products ranging from Jira to Trello, which offer sometimes similar services across a category of brands. But it's still one where, when it comes to the brand tone, which is their design, when it comes to the brand tone and messaging, And when it comes to just their internal clarity around the brand, it seems to be something that's just incredibly on point. Like that's honestly one of the aspirational brands that we take when we're doing a B2B rebrand.
Okay.
So that's the kind of process that we follow. And earlier what's been the case is that these processes have been a little more, I would say, on the technical side, on the research side. Okay. But now more and more, these are ones where you have to be much more impressionable.
Yeah.
You have to be much more B2C or business to person.
Yeah.
As we generally push for it. And the ones that you mentioned, when it comes to MailChimp or when it comes to Slack, when it comes to Notion, these guys have like such an easy to catch sort of a brand voice.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, because I think all of them play into the idea of we're catering to a customer who's a part of a business, right? So they're not saying, oh, we're catering to this business as a whole. You're trying to, I think they use the ideology of designing for B2C into B2B, and that's what makes it really fun for people to use, because you feel like it's personalized for you, it's more interactive, and I think that's where now I see design and marketing for B2B going, that you're taking inspiration from ideology of B2C and applying it into this bigger segment. Especially because now everything's freaking, I don't know if I'm allowed to abuse.
I still say
freaking instead. Everything's so automated, right? And everything's super like streamlined. Everything's on a computer. Everything seems really rigid. So within these systems, if you have something that's personalized and human, I think it makes that brand more approachable and user-friendly.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. Where technology earlier took us from 1 to 1,000.
Yeah.
Now this is tech that's taking us from 1,000 to 1,050.
Yeah.
And over there, if your team's not ready to use the product because it's so rigid or so...
Yeah.
I'm looking at probably like the early 2000 Microsoft Teams experience.
Yeah.
If it's something like that, it's not going to work. If people aren't using it if they don't want to use it in an organization, the organizations
exactly
get that
thing. Exactly. Yeah.
Definitely. That's on point.
Yeah.
Any other brands that you've seen that also just, you know, where you look at them and you're like, oof, like these guys get it right. These brands get it right. What are those kind of brands?
I mean, I would go from a very, I mean, maybe this is a direct to customer sort of brand, but for me, Nike is a brand that works so well with everything they do, from their marketing to design. Like, they're so consistent and they're constantly playing on this human emotion of like wanting to achieve. And they, like, I think for me, that's an aspirational brand, like Nike.
When your branding and marketing is so good that you can hide hundreds of stitches.
No one's perfect.
So one of the things I've noticed about Nike while I'm pretending to research, and this has already been told to me by Bhanu sitting behind the camera, is that they've moved all of their marketing and branding in-house. And so the two things, the two moves that they've done is right, is that one, they moved all of their marketing and branding in-house. And second, they haven't manufactured a shoe for 25 years.
Right.
What the hell is that all about? Like, just continuing on what we were talking about, right? If you get branding and marketing right, is this kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, it's a smart business, right? Like, it's a really smart business move where you're not... I think your expenditure on that front on manufacturing is lowered, but you're spending instead on marketing your product. And I just think it's a really smart business move, and they've done it well. And I think moving it internally, like you were saying, that it just helps maintain that cohesiveness. And I think it is really hard to communicate that to external agencies sometimes, especially when you're a company as big as Nike. It's really hard because it goes through so many levels of communication that somewhere Chinese whispers messes even one.
But yeah, so Nike seems to get it right. And how would you say that it have a significant advantage over, say, you know, the closest competitors that it's got, which is like you've got your Adidas and Puma.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what other brands are out there because I just wear two pairs of shoes throughout. But do you see it as a very significant move? Do you see it as a brand that significantly stands out when compared to some of its peers?
I believe it does. I won't even say think. I believe it does. And again, it's about how they've marketed themselves. So I think playing on people's aspirations is a great way to go. And they used like Michael Jordan as like, look at him.
Yeah.
This one boy, look where he's come from and look where he's gotten and look at the shoes he's wearing. And if you wear the kind of shoes he does, could you be the next Michael Jordan? And they really played with human emotion over there. And I think with everything they do, with how they target like sports for women, you know, they really like they genuinely touch, like they pull on a chord with you. And even with, say, what's his name? Phil Knight releasing the book Shoe Dog. Right? I feel like I haven't seen as much marketing or as many things come out from other brands like Adidas or Reebok or Puma. And I mean, I love all these brands. Of course, I love Nike more because I think it's more of that. Oh, I need to have that that Air Jordan. But I love Adidas. I think they're a great brand. I think their shoes are amazing. I love Puma. I have so many Puma jackets. But I don't think anyone's worked on marketing as hard as Nike has. And that's the only reason that they stand out more.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Like, the Nike-Jordan partnership is something that everyone knows about. That,
yeah.
Those Jordan ads are iconic, right?
Yeah. If you ask anyone, the first thing they'll say is, yeah, Nike Air Jordans. Yeah, I know that. But like, if you go into like a line that maybe Adidas might have released, do we really know the brand? Like, do we... I feel like it's always on people's mind. You can be a baller, you can't be a baller, but you know Nike Air Jordans. Like, they've done that really well.
Nice. That's our quote for the day. Can't be a baller, or you cannot be a baller. You know what it is.
Yeah.
Have you seen something similar in the B2B side as well? I know this sort of puts us on the spot here because when it comes to B2B, somehow it's not made to be loud in most cases. Like, I've very rarely seen ads that are properly targeted at me when it comes to, say, some of the more brand heavy channels,
right?
YouTube or the thing,
yeah,
like that, right? But is there one that seems to sort of particularly stand out where you're like, oh, these guys talk about it?
I think a really cool marketing ad that MailChimp did, where they asked people to use words that sounded like MailChimp but wasn't MailChimp. It was like kale shrimp and like trail imp. And they asked people to jot down a bunch of them, and they made like tiny snippets of what each of these businesses would do. And it made people eventually reach MailChimp's website and realize what they do.
Right.
So it was like a fun little thing where it was like interacting with your customers. It wasn't boring for sure. It wasn't like, oh, we are a mailing, like you can use us to write newsletters and send it out and grow your business. They didn't do any of that. They just did this really fun little campaign where it was like, what does MailChimp sound like? A bunch of jargon. And then you suddenly reach MailChimp's website because you're like looking up these other brands. And yeah, they just got like about
like the B2B2C approach.
Yeah.
You're targeting the users,
exactly,
inside the company that that will actually be making that,
exactly, yeah, definitely.
Sounds great. So any final closing thoughts when it comes to this, something important and insightful?
I think for me the advice is for both B2B and B2C is that, and I think I would say it on a more India level than on a global level, is that I think we just need to be more experimental. I think we need to be more risk-taking. Like, I know our customer, like our customer base and the audience you're reaching, I know why we are safe with our marketing and our design, but I think a good way to stand out is to really stand out. Like, take that risk. If it's a mistake you think you can afford, not a mistake, but a risk you think you can afford, I think you should definitely do it, whether you're a B2B or a B2C brand. I think we just need to be more risk-taking.
Yeah.
Like, I'm done with boring this.
Don't B2B or B2C, just
yeah.
Me.
Yeah, just me.